What's up? This is Kinsley, and you're listening to the Curls and Courage podcast. What's up, you guys, and welcome back to another episode of the Curls and Courage podcast. If you're new here, I'm your host, as always, Kinsley Meeks, and I am a mental health advocate, a coach, and an athlete, really just aiming to inspire you to reach your highest physical and mental potential. I am super excited for today's episode because today we are going to be having our first guest who has definitely made a difference in my life and a guest that I feel like you guys are just going to absolutely love hearing talk about their personal health and wellness journey. We have James Elliott on the show today. And before I let James hop on the pod, I want to just take a moment to actually introduce him and give you guys a little bit more of an inside scoop on who James is and what he does. James is truly a wealth of knowledge and inspiration who specializes in helping others improve their mental health by finding fulfillment, building mental resilience, and creating a life in which you thrive rather than just survive. James is a psychotherapist with over 6 years of coaching experience who has helped transform the lives of many. From National League rugby teams to Paralympic rowers, from special forces operators to devoted war veterans, from high-level bikini athletes to lifestyle individuals, James has dedicated his life to helping others, including myself. When I was at my worst in my mental health journey, I reached out to James, who gave me a fresh perspective and provided a safe space allowing me to be vulnerable and honest with myself. James is also a best-selling author and offers both in-person and online therapy, as well as multiple courses and motivating content to help you cultivate the best version of self. And let me tell you guys, this podcast episode truly left me feeling inspired. James and I dive into deep topics that are key to our overall well-being. We explore how mental health is essential for personal growth and how our childhood experiences shape our adult lives. James shares insights on the power of understanding trauma, the importance of self-compassion, and how exercise should be seen as a celebration rather than a chore. Y'all already know I love this point of view. We also talk about imposter syndrome, the role of forgiveness, and why finding balance is crucial for our mental health. From the significance of community support to the importance of core values and sustainable fitness, James and I cover it all. I hope you enjoyed this conversation just as much as I did and leave this episode with a better understanding on how education, compassion, and balance can transform your life. Prioritizing both your mental and your physical health truly makes all of the difference. With that being said, James, the man, the goat, the legend, thank you so much for coming on today's show. I truly am super excited to learn more about your personal wellness journey and really just have too many questions for you to answer.
Thank you so much. Whenever you work with a client like outside of, say, therapy, like say they have a podcast, you know, I work with a lot of like athletes and a lot of kind of well-known people, and they introduce you and they say, like, this person was my therapist and they changed my life. Just imagine living in a world whereby so many people who you work with are constantly telling other people how much you changed their life. Like, it's this really, at times, quite overwhelming. It almost feels like a bit, not drowning, because it sounds like I'm trying to reject a compliment, and we should never reject compliments, because when we reject a compliment, our brain doesn't really know the difference between that and self-deprecation. So we should always do our best to accept compliments. But when it's just constantly surrounded by people who say, the things that you say and the things that you've written and the things that you produce, like, really change my perspective of the world and really help. And it always feels like quite a bizarre feeling. And I guess elements of that is imposter syndrome, which is something that we all suffer with and isn't necessarily a bad thing. At least a perspective of it isn't a bad thing. But when actually people talk about me like that, you know, it's, you sit here and you have to kind of nod and smile and say thank you. I just think, like, it's such a beautiful world. And that's such a beautiful thing to have created. It feels overwhelming at times that people sit there and say, you know, your content's amazing, I find you inspirational. Because obviously we never see ourselves in that light. Like, I would never describe myself
You're so humble too, I feel like, which is, you know, amazing. But like, seriously, you know, like, I'm sure it's so fulfilling what you do and what you've done for me and the lives of others. Just being able to do that is something special for sure.
Well, thank you. Like, I went into a university and did a talk. And they're like, oh, this guy's a VIP. He's this modern day philosopher and psychotherapist. And I genuinely sat there like, oh, wow, this is exciting. Who are they introducing? And they're like, James Elliott. And I'm like, oh, that's me. I wouldn't say that I'm a philosopher. And then the person was like, but your book went number 9th in the world for philosophy. And you're like, okay, but I don't know that writing a book makes me a philosopher. And then they were like, but that's how all philosophers became philosophers. Like Plato was a philosopher because he wrote 26 books on philosophy. And you go, okay, that's a fair point. But so maybe I need a turtleneck and a pipe and just walk around. But yeah, no, it is. It's beautiful. So thank you so much for, thank you so much for your patience. I am like crazily busy. I'm in the UK for the next 2 days. And then I'm flying off to Germany. And then I'm back for a little bit. I have been asked to do some work over in the States. So I watch this space, like doing some talks and stuff, but it just massively all depends on so many different things. I'm currently working on this like, amazing project. Like, honestly, you would find it so fascinating. There's a couple of times when I'm on like certain projects and I think of people who I've worked with, I thought, oh, they would really love this. So I'm on a cancer rehabilitation project. So it's for, this is one of the projects that I'm on, but it's men over the age of 55 who've had prostate cancer. And can we provide emotional support to them in a way that's going to help them with their recovery? So working on things like identity, because identity is something that is a core element of ourselves that gets shaken after a really hideous illness, particularly like men of a certain age. Like we tend to think of ourselves as invincible. You know, we call middle age our 50s and 60s. Well, actually, the average man's living to about 77. So your middle age is actually 38 and a half, right? So actually middle age is in your 30s, which is a really scary thought. And so one of the name of what it is that I'm doing with them is psychoneuroimmune endocrinology, which is basically how you think affects the way that the brain communicates with itself, right? So if we constantly think about negative things, the neurotransmitters, what gets exchanged is loads of cortisol and a bit of adrenaline and stuff like that, right? So we in our brains, we can notice an increase of stress. But that feeling of stress, we can feel that physiologically, right? When you're stressed and when you're worked out, when you constantly feel, you feel down, like you feel empty, you feel drained. We notice those physiological responses, which actually then affects the way that organs communicate with themselves. The classic example of this is something that's that we find very much throughout literature, particularly like romance novels, which is the idea of dying of a broken heart, which is just simply, you're just so depressed that actually your body isn't communicating the way it should. And your body just begins to shut down. You know, we spoke just before we started about the importance of community to you. And actually like loneliness is very much something, a psychoneuroimmune endocrinology phenomenon that we can see where people who are lonely, it begins to express. Think about when people are stressed, they come out in hives. The classic one, come out in skin rash because you're stressed. That's psychoneuroimmune endocrinology. So actually doing that with cancer rehabilitation survivors, because the role that we're now understanding that stress plays in cancer is unbelievable. Like the huge leaps forwards that we've had in science. So I'm working on some like really fascinating projects that are filling up so much time, but yeah, amazing. And one of those is psychoneuroimmune endocrinology and cancer survivors, and someone who's a PT, like such as yourself, someone who's an online coach, yeah. Right, would just be so interested in like the what we can actually observe in the health effects. Like, can we reduce cancer, or the risk of cancer, I should say, by challenging someone's perspective of themselves through psychotherapy? And effectively, the answer is like, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, that sounds absolutely incredible. No, say, yeah. I'm already like so intrigued. I'm like, I can't say anything.
Yeah.
I'm like just trying to listen. No, that's amazing. Yeah. And just like what a big role, as you mentioned, kind of like stress too plays on the body and everything that we do. That sounds like a really exciting project. And I want to ask you too, kind of while we're on that topic, how did you get into what you do now, you know, with mental health coaching? Why are you so passionate about what you do? When did you get started? Kind of tell me about like your come up in your career.
So I had issues with my mental health. And lots of kind of stuff went on in my personal life, breakdown of my relationship with my daughter's mum and difficulty. And I came from like lots of childhood abuse and like a really dangerous and abusive environment, and caregivers going to prison and mental health issues with caregivers, and loads of physical and emotional and all sorts of types of abuse. Right. So I joined the army and I joined the military and I joined the airborne and I served in Afghanistan, and get to like 2015 and just everything had just kind of overflowed. Like the analogy of the stress bucket was very accurate for me, where just lots and lots of trauma on top of trauma on top of trauma, where I was just that, no, I'm not dealing with that. I'm not even thinking about it. Mental health isn't real, until inevitably like your own. falls apart. Mine like really fell apart, and it was at this point where I've never felt so depressed and so suicidal. I'd got to this point of suicidality, and this was before the days where the army would do like rigorous checks into your mental health. Now the army is very rigorous in their checks into your mental health, but like, I was diagnosed with childhood depression, even on my medical records, which is in the 90s. So like a child having mental health issues in the 90s in the UK was like not spoken about, like let alone going onto my medical records. And it says significant physical abuse, like on my medical records. Like I've actually got that screenshot and talk about it, because that was, you know, really strange back then. It just wasn't something that was ever really acknowledged. So to be abused to the point where it goes on your permanent medical file as a child, you know, back then was wild, really. And so then, like, you know, my mental health kind of boiled over, and I was in a really bad place. And a really good friend of mine came to me and was like, Colchester Rugby Club want a strength conditioning coach. Colchester is my local team. I live in Colchester in Essex in England. Okay. And he kind of frog marched me to Colchester Rugby Club and said, you're going to be their new strength conditioning coach. And I just fell in love with it. So I was getting to coach these like young athletes who were at national league level. So national league rugby is a very, very high level of rugby. I'd get to coach these really talented athletes, you know, teaching them about bench press and deadlifts and squatting and overhead pressing and sprinting and fitness and health and all of that type of stuff. And like, they'd never had that. But the thing that I really enjoyed was the conversations that I would have. It was lovely seeing guys getting stronger and getting fitter and performing how they wanted to perform on a rugby pitch. Of course it was. But what was actually really beautiful about it was the conversations that I could have with that individual that would make them change the way that they perceive themselves. And I was like, oh, actually, I'm really into that. Now, I was going through my own therapy and doing my own therapeutic learning and psychoeducation at the time, and like trying to change how I felt about myself and perceive the world around me, doing my own therapy. And I was like, do you know what? There's a real space here, because there's this wonderful Carl Jung quote, which is, you can learn all the therapies and read all the texts, but when you touch another human being's soul, just be a human being with a soul. And I was like, there's this space I feel that I can really connect with guys. And actually, if I can translate what I'm given in my therapy and help guys through understanding of that, like translating that for them, if I can help. So I was like, well, I want to get into counseling. I want to get into therapy. Now, this actually really helped my own mental health. And I was reintroduced in work and became a parachuting instructor. So it's a big thing. You have them in the American army. They're called jump masters. But the British army never had those before. So they're like, well, actually, what we want to do is we want to create a platoon of jump masters. We want 8 guys. And I was asked if I was interested. So down I went to the parachute training school. Became one of the British Army's first like jump masters, parachute and jumping instructors, we call them APJIs. And what I was doing was I was taking these key psychological skills that I used with these high-performing rugby playing athletes. I was using them in young soldiers. So things like anxiety regulation, boosting confidence, like self-perception, all of these things actually played massive roles within the military community. But we'd only ever applied them to athletes. And I was like, wow, there's this real marked improvement of performance of these young guys. And actually how I can communicate with them is massively changing how they're perceiving themselves. And then next thing you know, Army headquarters had got wind of what I was doing. They come and spoke to me about it. And then basically took me out of the parachute training school, brought me into Army headquarters, and were like, we want you to run mental resilience training for the south of the country. Yeah, that's how it started.
Incredible.
Yeah, it was mad. Yeah, it was honestly, it seemed so arbitrary. It was just like, I was just like, yeah, I'll do it. Yeah, I'll do it. Like, just saying yes. No,
I will say, I feel like too, whenever we're trying to like, or from my experience anyways, like trying to figure out our career, it's always based off a trauma or like a hardship that we've gone through that kind of inspires us. You said you struggled a lot with depression. You struggled a lot with your mental health and your confidence and your mental resilience. And then now you're like being able to get through that yourself, overcome it, and then be able to share that knowledge that you've learned with other people. And I want to ask you too, I feel like you go ahead.
Yeah, you caught on to something so beautiful there. So people, they say, well, you are what you do. And no, you do what you are.
You do what you are. I love that. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So am I healing my inner child by being for other young men, not just young men, but like in that moment, it was just young men. But then was I healing because I was being for them what nobody was for me? Right. So now I have this clinic and I've got so many people online and I work on Harley Street and I'm involved in all of these projects. Am I healing? Does this job heal me because I'm able to be for other people what nobody was for me? Particularly when it comes to people who have like traumatic experiences. Because nobody was having these conversations with me. Nobody was talking to me about what my brain was doing, why my body was responding the way it was, why my parents didn't express love in a healthy way, why the abuse happened. Nobody was explaining that to me. So when a caregiver, for example, when a caregiver stops loving a child, the child does not stop loving the caregiver. The child stops loving themselves. And so when you grow up in an environment that is unsafe, where you don't feel loved, where there's no psychological or physical or either or types of safety, you're going to think that's because of you. And so you're going to develop survival techniques, defense mechanisms. You're going to become a version of yourself that you needed to be to survive. And then that's going to carry on into adulthood. That's where we see things like attachment styles, right? Because you're becoming what you needed to
do. That's what I was going to ask you too. I don't mean to interrupt, but I want to make sure I ask you this.
Please.
Yeah, no, so, because you talked a lot about, and I know this is it's a hard topic, but I want to go deep with you, and you're so honest, which I absolutely love. So thank you for that, first off. And this will help so many people. But you talk a lot about, you know, going through abuse as a child, whether it be emotionally, physically. And I just want you to speak a little bit more on that if you can. And then we're talking about how what we go through as children affects how we go through things in adulthood, which is so interesting because a lot of times we don't really think about that. And I actually remember that whenever we had one of our first sessions, you were asking me like, what does your childhood look like? And I'm thinking like, why is this man asking me about my childhood? Like, what do you care? Like, what does this matter? So talk a little bit more about, if you don't mind, what you how does what we go through affect our lives, I guess, as we develop as adults?
So, my biological dad was a drug dealer. That's how he made his money. So he used to import drugs into the UK through, it was under the guise of luxury chocolates. So he used to take me. So he would drive the work van with all his work branding on the side, and he'd pick up these chocolates, but he'd be picking up cocaine with it. And then he would go to these restaurants and deliver the chocolates in the go to these hotels and drop off the chocolates, but the hotels were actually buying the coke off of him. Hotels don't like drug dealers to come into their premises. They would rather sell it themselves. That's because drug dealers bring in violence and da-da-da, particularly like these top-end hotels. Inevitably, things fell apart. Things fell apart because he was foolish with his money. So he would buy lots of lavish things, and the tax man is going to go, why has this man got cars and houses and da-da-da-da-da if he's just selling chocolates? Like, he's got financial worth is a lot more than he could ever make. So what's going on there? So first, he was a fool with money. Secondly, never get high off your own supply. He used to take a lot of cocaine. And the problem is, whenever you've been around someone who takes lots of cocaine, it often reflects violently. And whether you are 5 years old or 13 years of age, when you're trapped with someone who's taken a lot of cocaine, the violence is going to be aimed at you. So he used to really violently beat my mum. Like, lots of my early childhood memories are like trying to hide behind the toilet. I have an older sister. She's a year older than me. Like, trying to hide as locking the bathroom door, like hearing my mum getting like beaten a lot. And she left and she took my sister. My sister went with her and she left. So now I'm left with this guy. And so he was really abusive. He went to prison when I was 13. By this point, I was now living full time with my mum. He just like had completely lost the plot. But inevitably, there's this damaged child who grew up in a really violent, awful environment. And then he's going into this environment where my mum, my sister, she had remarried, and he had, so we've got two stepbrothers all of a sudden. And like, it's poverty, you know, we're poor. Yeah, there's loads of violence in this house. There's some arguing, there's constant fighting. There's just a house full of traumatized people. That's a great description for that. It's a house full of traumatized people. My mum was traumatized as a child and then got in a relationship with this guy who used to beat her. My sister watched her mum get beaten, her brother get beaten in an escape. And then me, the brother who'd been beaten, and then the stepbrothers who were carrying their own trauma from the breakup of their stepdad and their mum. And like, you know, just awful environment for all of us. And so at 16, I left and went homeless. I became in and out of staying with them and staying with friends and staying on the street and staying wherever you can. And yeah, at 18, I went and joined the army. The army went, where's your dad? I went, prison. Where's your mum? She ain't interested. They went, you'll be a paratrooper. And off I went. And it was just amazing. But it was then so fascinating to see, kind of to look back now professionally and like analyze myself and my own behaviors to go, that was just, I was being what I felt I needed to have become to have survived. So angry, unpredictable, rude, belligerent, like just horrible to be around, really. That was a version of me that I had learned, this exterior that I had learned to protect myself, right? So that was how I was, like, interpersonal relationships when it comes to friendships. And like this will to dominate. Like, I had this real, I had to be better than everybody else. I had to think that I was fitter, faster, tougher, which is just like the worst type of people to be around, right? They're just such hard work. Just constantly looking for an opportunity to get ahead, to be better. And I was like, in my head, that was what was playing. And if somebody was a bit pathetic, like in your troop, in your section, in your platoon, whatever the vernacular was, you would just be like, piece of shit. Like, hate him, disgusting, pathetic. Because then that's me then really kind of bullying them to make me feel better about myself, because that's the example that was set to me. That's what I thought normality was, and that's how I used to behave. And so I projected that onto people around me. And then when it came to like my romantic side, I basically dated women who made me feel shit about myself, because that's what I thought love was, right? So I think my mum was a very beautiful woman who effectively gave me abandonment issues, was very violent, would make me feel awful about myself, would say terrible things. I think I was 15 at the time, and I'm like, I'm dropping out of school, and I'm like failing school, but I'm like, do you know what? I kind of want to change. I really want to go to university. And she went, the only way you're ever going to go to university is to clean their toilets. And I just like, it just destroyed me. It took me like, I mean, now I'm a master of science in war and psychiatry, but that took me
amazing. Yeah,
but that took me nearly like, I mean, I graduated what, a year ago. So that what she said there stuck with me for about 15 years. It took me about 7 years of studying to get to the end of my, so it stuck with me for about 15 years. That would push me away from
that phrase,
right? Yeah, like I can't do that. Like I'm incapable. Because I'm too stupid.
Yeah.
And actually, it was when I was in the military that lots of people who I worked with were going like, stop saying you're stupid. I used to go, don't get it. Fucking don't get it. And they're like, you do get it. And there was just a couple of like example circumstances whereby I came out with something and they were like, you're not stupid at all, but you're not. You say you are, but you've just worked that out, or you've just done that. So anyway, that's a great example of how we project from our childhood into our adulthood. And yeah, and romantically, if a girl was like, obviously like a walking, talking red flag, someone who would be abusive and awful and terrible to me, I would be like, yeah, that.
Like, this that, is perfect that, for me.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, she's really horrible. Oh, perfect. Oh, she makes me feel really stupid. And you'd be like, wow, yeah, that's what I want.
Yeah.
Oh, they're really avoidant. And actually their defense mechanism is to lash out. Oh, perfect. That would be what I wanted. And guys, my friends would be like, why are you putting up with that?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I dated a girl once for like 2.5 years who would interrupt me every time she could. She would like shout me down in front of people. And guys were like, she's a very beautiful woman, James. But she's also one of the worst people I've ever met in my life. She's a terrible person. She's so rude to you. And as actually a friend of mine, she's also a very, very well-known psychotherapist. She said, like, she's awful. Like, she makes me uncomfortable to be around. And this woman is one of my closest friends. And still I was like, no, everything will be fine. But I knew that it wasn't fine. She was validatingly beautiful, right? So she was beautiful. And if I belittled and destroyed myself enough for her, then that means that I would be worthy of that love. How awful is that? Because that's what we learn to believe. That's what we just accept as normality. And it wasn't until I was 32, 33, and I'm dating this girl, and she's very lovely, she's very beautiful, she models. She was really rude, and she went on a date with another guy whilst we were dating, but we were physical. So I have this rule about, like, there's no sex before monogamy, right? If we're together, we're together, but you're not physical with anyone else. And she had been dating whilst we were being physical. And I said, why did you do that? And she said, I want to make you jealous. And I just said, I'm not entertained. I've done so much therapy. I understand, like, if we rewind 5 years ago, I'm playing a game to be worthy of that love, but now that I've gone through therapy, I'm just not even entertaining that. I'm just going, okay, cool, see you later, like, goodbye, best of luck.
Yeah. I got you.
goodbye. Yeah. Because I don't entertain it. Because remember, it's not about what you attract, because you can't tell off the bat who a person is. It's not about what you attract, but it is about what you entertain.
That's so true. Like, it's about what you put up with. Yeah.
Correct. No, yeah.
No, thank you so much for sharing all of that. Yeah, no. And that's super interesting. Yeah. So you feel like what really helped you like overcome, again, the trauma that you went through as a child and like how it affected your relationships. Like, that's crazy. Even like into the, you know, age of, you know, up into your 30s, 15 years, it's still affecting you. What do you feel like helped you overcome that the most? What was that turning point to you? You're with this girl and it's affecting your relationships, the way you see yourself, you're thinking you're stupid, all of these things are adding up. But then finally you're like, no, like, I'm not entertaining it anymore. I'm smart. Yeah. I'm going to make sure like I'm true to myself. Like, I know what I'm doing. I'm not putting up with people treating me terribly anymore. What made you kind of switch that mentality? Like, how did you do that? Even though your childhood made you feel a certain type of way?
I think there was a huge amount around education. So therapy was obviously huge for me. Understanding why we're doing what we're doing is the first step really to, first step is admitting there's a problem, but then when you understand why am I doing what I'm doing? Like, why am I doing this? And even like, every single attitude, behavior, and belief has a source, right? There's a reason that we do things. We learn the blueprint for life. This is what life is going to look like. We learn the blueprint for life as children. And so then when we become adults, we then see that playing out. We then add a little bit more to that blueprint, but effectively it's still the same walls. It's still the same stairs. It's still the same shape, right? We can see that. And so actually understanding and going, do you think that you respond the way that you respond to challenge from other men is because you're actually deeply insecure about who you are because your parents never accepted and loved you. And you're like, that would make loads of sense. Like, when someone says something to me, the way that I feel really insecure. So I lash out like that. And they say, okay, cool. Well then how would you rather respond to that? Well, I'd probably rather just take it at the face value that it was, which is either criticism, which is actually quite helpful. If it's not helpful criticism and it is just someone taking a swipe, then just it not bother me because I'm so secure in who I am, or just laugh it off. Okay, cool. Well, how do we do that? Well, we need to resolve the insecurities that exist within me. Okay, cool. Well, let's resolve the insecurities. And then we begin to understand why people behave the way that they did towards us. Why was your mum so vile to you? Well, because actually her mum was even more vile to her in some of the darkest and most awful ways. So then actually my mum as a parent probably feels like she did an amazing job. Because she was like, but I didn't do to him the severity, the what could only be described as evil that happened to me. So my mum is there thinking that she's being an absolute hero. And then there's me thinking that my mum is the villain. But actually, what she has done is incredible. But we can't see that until we get this education, until we begin to understand why we're doing what we're doing and understanding why people behave the way that they did. Because when we understand why we do what we do, we can understand why other people do what they do. And we can kind of forgive them for it. And that's massive in healing. When you can understand that everybody's fighting battles and everybody's projecting their childhood lessons, and the 99% of the time, people don't mean the offense or the hurt that they've caused you. They were actually intending on doing something entirely different. Then you can begin to forgive them.
I think that's so true, because I feel like one of the biggest lessons that I learned as a child from my mom is she's like, you never know what someone's going through. So like, treat everyone with respect. Like, even if someone's bad to you, like, don't let someone step on you. But at the same time, like, be compassionate, be forgiving, be honest. And I think that's so hard to do, because we, a lot of times as humans, are like taking things personally, or we see everyone as like they're out to get us. Like, I do that too. I have a hard time like trusting people, but it's more like you said, like understanding and seeing we're all human. Everyone has their own flaws. Everyone's going through something. So like being able to approach that with more, I guess, like compassion is what I see. Like, how do you cultivate that compassion, like, for other people, and not see when someone's doing you wrong, intentionally seeing them as like, this person is just hurting, you know, I'm not going to let this affect me. How do you do that?
Well, isn't it interesting that the people who often have no compassion for other people also really lack compassion for themselves? Like, people who like, oh, you work hard and nobody cares. Did it use that, like, that awful, like, the whole thing around like grind culture? You know, work harder, do more, work harder. Like, it feels like it's built around two things, which is capitalism and an absent parent. Like, when you feel like you're not enough and you have to earn your parents' love all the time through achievement, and then you live in a society based around the more you work, the more we'll give you special tokens so that you can afford to live. Then actually that's in a really terrible concoction for this grind culture where people are like, answering emails at 2-3 o'clock in the morning. That's terrible. Go on.
That's wild. I feel like even for me personally, and I live in Miami, like it's hustle culture here. Like we're all working hard. Like you said, like it doesn't matter. There's no business hours. I think I texted someone that the other day and I was like, wait, hold on a second. Like we need to have some business hours and we need to have some balance. And I know that's one of my issues and my listeners as well, you know, struggling with balance and struggling with mental health is partially because of that. And I feel like you're such a busy man. You have so much going for you. How do you find balance, or is that something you're still working on? Or like, what's your recommendations or a few tips to find that balance? Because that's hard.
So, it is. I recognize first and foremost, before I'm a therapist, before I'm a father, before I'm a businessman, before I'm any of that, I'm a human being. And human beings were absolutely designed to frolic. Yeah, designed to frolic in the woods. We were designed to eat berries and frolic in the woods. Like you've got your priorities the wrong way around. But then here's where the reality of it comes forward, which is we're living in a cost of living crisis, right? Like without wandering down the very complicated route of politics, like economically, America is in dire straits. And in the UK, you know, because of things like housing prices and market instability, leaving the European Union was a huge economic mistake for the UK. Hopefully one that we are going to rectify in the next couple of years. We have to work more and have to work harder to put food on the table. So I do fully recognize that. But it's about being really mindful of the fact that you're actually a human being. And human beings have needs. Like, you're a human first. So you need to eat. You need to drink your water. You need to get your sleep. You need to spend time away from a screen. Like, nothing about human behavior makes any sense until we view it through a lens of evolutionary biology. Like, you understand that we have evolved sociologically far quicker than we ever could biologically. So as a society, we've created this insane environment of hyperstimulation and pressure and stress and work emails. You know, like, what on earth is a tax return? Like, I want to run about and fight with my mates in the woods. What you want about tax return? But that's not what your brain thinks, and understandably. So you're a human being first. So like, exercise. And exercise isn't a punishment. Exercise is a celebration of what your body can achieve.
Yes, like, be a human being. Mentality. I think I'm always trying to tell people, like, oh, I have to go to the gym. It's such a chore. I'm like, what you mean it's a chore? You're literally like making your body and your mind better. You're strengthening your body, strengthening your mind, cultivating good but well-being. Like, why is that a chore? Why is this like, oh, this sucks? Like, it's awesome. Like, you know?
Yeah, no, but you're right. It is awesome. And it is great. Yeah. And it is great for you. And it's like, yeah, but so that is a celebration, not a punishment. And lots of people really, really struggle with that mentality, but it's true. And then we've got exercise, we've got eating healthy. Like, we eat a lot of food with a lot of chemicals in it that the body is like, what on earth is this? I don't like this. I don't know what this is. That stresses us out. We don't like it. So like, good food, good rest, good sleep, spending time with friends. Like, everything from sexual behaviors to interpersonal relationships to actually how you can even perform at work, they're all shaped by, are you being a human being first?
A human being first. So you think that's what that's what it really comes down to? Because I've never heard anyone say that. Because, you know, we get our identities, I feel like, wrapped up in this one certain thing. Like, I've been there too. And then I'm like, wait, hold on. Like, let me step back a second. But a lot of people go through that. Maybe they're, you know, a CEO of a big business, or they're like me, they're an athlete, they're a bodybuilder, and that's their only concern. Or, you know, they have this really amazing job or this really amazing family. But it's like, at the end of the day, like you said, like, we're all human. So I think having that mentality
super helpful. And do you know what's really, really fascinating about the examples that you've used there is that they're all nouns. What's the issue with associating your identity to a noun? The issue with associating your identity to a noun is someone could take that from you.
That's true. Yeah.
That's a problem.
I am a mom. I am a, because all of those things could be like stripped away in a moment.
Some idiot doesn't look at a junction and hits you from the side at 60 miles an hour. All of a sudden, you're not a bodybuilder anymore.
Yeah.
But then you don't know who you are.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I work with how many veterans? And they go, I'm a paratrooper. And you're like, well, that's a problem. Well, why is it? Well, because whether you like it or not, whether it by time or by choice or by medical discharge or by a little bit of bad discipline, you're not going to be a paratrooper. In fact, you're only going to be a paratrooper for a very short period of time. So what happens when you're no longer that paratrooper? Who actually are you? It's a really important question, Kenzie. You should be asking ourselves all the time, like, who are you when you're, if you're not a bodybuilder? Like, who are, because if you associate your identity to a noun could be taken from you. And I know that's really dark, particularly when it comes to parenthood, but that's also the truth.
But no, that's so true. Yeah. And with a career or anything, yeah, because you're not at the end of the day, like, you're a human first. No, 100%.
Right.
That's a great, I'm like trying, I'm listening to my own therapy session. I'm like listening. No. That's
right. Awesome. So then I get, what I encourage people to do, associate your identity to an adjective and verbs or adverbs. Mm-hmm. So like coaching is a great one for you. Charisma is a great one for you. You're very charismatic. You love coaching. Okay, cool. That's a large part of your identity. There's another large part of our identity is our core values. You say to someone, right, what's your core values? And they're like, I don't know. You know, why don't you know that? I've never asked myself that question. Okay, cool. Well, you should. You should ask yourself.
Definitely, yeah.
Right, what are my core, what's important to me? Resilience, wisdom, and compassion. That's for me. Knowledge is knowing what the right answer is. Wisdom is knowing if you should say it.
That is
so knowledge true. Is knowing knowledge is knowing that tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is knowing it doesn't go in a fruit salad. That's the easiest way of explaining that. But then, so we should ask ourselves these questions. Like, who do you want to be? And if one of your core values is wisdom, say core value is a wisdom for me. It's about trying to learn what wisdom actually is and when it's appropriate to say something or when it's appropriate to not say something and how we can say it and what we can do and how am I helping people, all that type of stuff, right? That wisdom, if we're developing that understanding, that has to be expressed through behaviors. You can't say your core value is respect, but when was the last time you displayed any behavior that showed any respect? You can't say, well, my core value was respect.
Actions
and say something.
Speak louder than words. Perfect example. Actions speak louder than words at the end of the day.
Right. Yeah. Exactly that. Yeah, you aren't what you say you are. You are what you do. The only tangible way I've got of knowing what your identity is by the actions that you choose to display to the world. So if someone says, oh, I'm core value, and they go, and I've got a list of core values, they go, respect. Okay, cool. When was the last time you were really respectful to someone? Well, someone disrespected me, so I disrespected them back. Oh, that's an example of how you disrespected someone, not how you respected someone. And then, you know, they'll say, well, kindness. Well, when was the last time you were kind? And wisdom for me is looking after my health to try and keep it within the parameters of the context of this podcast.
And that's what I want to ask you too. Like, this is a health and wellness based podcast, and health and wellness, it means a lot of different things. And I've discussed this before, you know, it's not just eating healthy. It's not just going to the gym. It's not just prioritizing your relationships or not just prioritizing your rest and recovery. It's a culmination of so many different things that make you mentally and physically well. So like, tell me a little bit more about what wellness looks like for you. I know you do some type of Brazilian jiu-jitsu, I think I read. You take care of your nutrition. You talk about the, you know, the dangers of processed foods and how much fitness means to you. Like, what does being well look like for you? What does your fitness routine look like?
So
daily,
I identify health as, this is a definition that I use, as a state of physical and emotional well-being.
Okay.
So health for me isn't just about going to the gym and eating good food. It's about how I feel as a person, how I feel within myself. So I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I do lots of the MMA stuff. I love it. I love wrestling. I love hitting pads. I love doing the jiu-jitsu. I love dragging people to the ground. I used to box. I played loads of rugby. I'm big into that. I really like Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Like lots of people, because of the sense of community, because of the challenge, because of the fitness of it. It's a really, really wonderful sport. And if you're listening and you're thinking, I want to do some cardio, but I hate walking on a treadmill on an incline for 45 minutes, which is absolutely fair enough, then probably don't do it. Go and try a sport. I've always found that really interesting about bodybuilders. I speak to them all the time and they say, oh, I hate this. I hate doing this cardio. And I'm saying, well, why'd you do it then? They go, well, I used to really love swimming. Why are you not swimming then? Like, oh, because I'm walking 45 minutes on an incline. Yeah, but you hate that. And actually, when we learn to do things, it's like this would be really helpful, actually, I think, for yourself and a lot of clients. It's really fascinating studies come out that basically, if there's loads of dopamine present in the brain when we're doing a task, it's only going to take about 20, 30 repetitions of that task before we've learned it, and it can become habitual. So habitual is where basically the neurons have linked. So our brain understands how to do something, and then it gets sealed in a thin layer of fat known as a myelin sheath. So this myelin sheath holds them. So it actually takes less energy. And by energy, I don't mean cosmic universal energy. I mean literal calorific expenditure. It takes less thought to conduct an action. Like when you drive, about 85% of the behaviors that happen when you drive happen under a guise of myelin sheath. That's because you're not thinking, this is all habitual, indicate, turn, da 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 da, what your feet are doing, the thing, doing all that type of stuff, right? That's all habitual, that's sealed myelin sheath. So if dopamine is present, so if you feel good when you're doing something, your body's like, oh, we like this. Your brain is like, oh, we like this, because dopamine makes us feel good and is linked to survival. So if you do something that ensures survival, you get a rush of dopamine, like eating, spending time with friends, exercising, because exercising, you're basically microdosing running away from a saber-toothed tiger. That's like how it feels for your body. Like you're microdosing danger. That's right. Like, so your body's like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, we're healthy. We're good. We like that. Sex, getting home, all that type of stuff that makes you feel good. Like that's your brain and survival going, cool. So if you can make a task enjoyable, so you reward yourself for doing it, it actually becomes a lot easier to remember, and you're far more likely to repeat that task. So if you can make cardio really enjoyable, people are far more likely to repeat cardio. Because they're like, their brain is like, oh, we like doing that. But if you make cardio boring and a punishment, they're far less likely to do it. Does that make sense?
100%, because that's one of the first questions like I'll ask. Like, of course, you know, at the end of the day, sometimes, you know, you're running and you're tired. It's just not going to be that enjoyable. Like, you know what I mean? But for the most part, one big question I ask my clients first, they're like, well, what am I going to be doing for cardio? And I'm like, well, what do you like to do for cardio? Like, let's try to keep your plan sustainable and enjoyable. Yeah. That way you're able to follow through. Cause you're right. If I'm sitting there and I hate being on the elliptical, like you said, and my coach is like, hey, let's do the elliptical for 2 hours a day. I'm going to dread it every single day. It's going to take up my mental capacity. I'm not going to like it. And I, you know, a lot of times if you're someone who's maybe not as dedicated and psycho about training as I am, you're not going to get it done, you know?
So yeah,
you have to find like what you enjoy. That makes sense 100%. And then also too, you're talking about like dopamine, which I know is and correct me if I'm wrong, but a neurotransmitter in the brain.
You got it.
Okay, so I know there's multiple neurotransmitters in the brain. I think there's three main ones. It's what, serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine. How do you pronounce it? Is it norepinephrine?
But there's norepinephrine. There's like glucocorticoids, like cortisol. There's your serotonin. There's your oxytocin, which is your pair bonding. Oxytocin is really fascinating because there's been this really terrible narrative that men are designed to like have sex with loads of women and spread and have loads of babies, but women aren't. But actually, like new studies into oxytocin have shown that actually men are sensitive to oxytocin, and there's these like fascinating experiments. Yeah, it's just the reason why women produce an egg a month and men produce loads of semen is because we're actually really, really, really bad at reproduction, but we're kind of designed to be like that so that only the quote unquote strongest babies survive. That's why we reproduce the way that we do. It's not so men can go and have sex with loads of different women. That's just such like a Victorian, I don't think it was Darwin, but I think it was a Victorian who came out with, that's clearly because men are designed to have sex. We're absolutely fine, it's our biological urge, but actually there's been lots of studies to suggest that it's completely not true. And we've got like adrenaline that exists, which obviously pairs into fight or flight. We've got cortisol. Cortisol isn't always necessarily a bad thing. If we took all of the cortisol out of your body, you wouldn't be happy. You would drop down dead because cortisol stimulates your heart rate.
We need a little bit of good stress.
So when we talk about like excessive amounts of cortisol over an extended period of time, that's where we talk about like chronic stress. But actually bits of cortisol are good. So really fascinating. As human beings, we're actually designed to have a spike of dopamine in anticipation for reward rather than in receipt of it. So you're designed to actually want to strive to try and do things, not just constantly get things. Consider a child opening their present on Christmas Day and they're like super excited and they rip the paper off. Unless it's like a PS5 or whatever it is now, unless it's like a PlayStation, they'll just go, oh wow, okay, cool, next. And they get that excitement and there's always that slight in them, because that's just how we're designed to be as human beings. We're designed to have a spike of dopamine in anticipation for reward. Fitness and health doesn't have an end. doesn't end when you die. And even then, we don't really know what happens. So let's not, don't put all your money on that. But fitness and health doesn't really have an end. This project that I'm on is for cancer survivors over the age of 55. Like, they're getting into their fitness at 55, over the age of 55.
Yeah, some of them are older.
Yeah. Like, it doesn't have an end. You are constantly rolling that boulder up, rolling that boulder up, rolling that boulder up. Don't aim for an end result. Enjoy the journey. If you enjoy the process of going to the gym, of doing your cardio, of lifting your weights, of doing your backflips, of strangling your mates, whatever it is for you, right? If you enjoy that, if you enjoy the process of doing that, you are far more likely to maintain that behavior. The person who enjoys running is always going to run a lot further than a person who just wants to run 5K, right?
That is so true, because I feel like in life, I mean, I remember even releasing a podcast episode about that like months back. Like, it's more about the journey rather than the destination, because we get so caught up on like these things that we want. But it's like, you can be, especially when it comes to health and fitness, you can be always evolving. There's always new things you can do. You can always get better, and you can do that from any age to, you know, any like, you could start young, prioritize it when you're older. It's more about what you do, enjoying the process of it. And that way it's more sustainable and not so restrictive, and you end up hating it and you're never going to go back to it. Yeah.
So then as a coach, then for you to have longevity with a client, for a client to want to stay with you for years and years and years and to really enjoy their fitness journey with you, is it more important to make what they're doing hard but going to reach their fitness goals quicker, or more enjoyable but making fitness sustainable?
Okay, so this is a great question. Okay, and I'll tell you, when I first started coaching, I would have a completely different answer to what I have now, because I feel like when we talk about like success with my clients and what I do, obviously with bodybuilding, like, it's hardcore, you know what I mean? It's hardcore. It's, hey, we're going to do whatever we need to do to get to where we want to be. And I started personal training when I was, I guess like 18, and I'm 23 now. So really the only thing I've done for most of my life, besides like outside jobs, serving and fast food or whatever. But anyways, so when I first started, it was like, at all costs, like with my clients, we're going to make this super hard. We're going to get down to the wire. I remember like one of the big mistakes I made with like personal training at first was pushing my clients too hard. To be honest with you, I'd have them at their first session doing battle ropes and squats and burpees and all this stuff, to the point to where they're literally feeling sick. And I'm like, okay, job well done to myself. And then later down the road, I think about it, I learn more, I gain more knowledge, I gain more experience, you know, and I say, like, this is not really helping anyone long term, you know what I mean? So maybe in my first early stages of coaching, it would be hardcore, let's get to the point, let's get to the grind. But I've realized that's not helping the client. If they don't want to do it and they can't sustain it, then it's not a plan that I'm going to put out there. So again, like, when I have consults with my clients now and I talk to them, I'm like, what can we do to keep you successful? How can I help you as a coach? How can we establish a sustainable plan? Because any trainer can work you hard in the gym. Any trainer or any nutrition coach can give you a plan that's going to be, hey, let's eat less calories, let's cut your fats and carbs down, let's only eat chicken and broccoli for the next 16 weeks. You're going to get lean, but are you going to enjoy it? No. Is it going to be sustainable? No. Are you going to have hormonal problems? Yes. Are you going to have mental health issues? Yes. So, you know, right now it's more about, hey, I want to push my clients. I'm going to make sure they work. You know, we're not just here to talk in our sessions, or we're not just online. I'm not just here to be your friend and say good job. No, but I'm here to coach you and create a plan that you can sustain long term. Because at the end of the day, it's about health. To me, it's about longevity. And like you said, it's more about feeling good than just looking good. It's about both. You see what I mean? So
yeah, I do. So interestingly to that, then, how many people do you know who have gone down the bodybuilding route, who have done bodybuilding for one or two seasons and then crashed out of it?
Oh, so many people. Or they'll post videos about how much they resent it and how much bodybuilding sucks and this coach ruined my life and my hormones are all messed up as a female. And yeah, I mean, It's definitely the nature within my sport, for sure. I mean, you can get easily burnt out on it. You can get easily damaged by it, I would say, mentally and physically. I love what I do, and it has some amazing traits to it as well. But you have to have, in the bodybuilding industry anyway, you have to have a good coach who actually cares and is not going to run you into the ground. And that's with lifestyle clients too. Someone who actually cares about your well-being versus like, let's just get to the end destination at all costs. Anybody can do that, you know?
Before we end today's show, I want to make sure you know how to reach me if you are interested in one-on-one fitness and nutrition coaching. My coaching service is all about helping you achieve fortitude through good physical and mental health. This is not only about looking good, but also feeling good. My nutrition and training programs are completely custom to your goals and needs and designed to help you be a better partner, CEO, employee, athlete, or just person in general. To get started, please send me a DM at yoitskenslow, that's yoitskenslow, or shoot me an email at kensleymeeksfit@gmail.com, that's kensleymeeksfit@gmail.com, to find your fortitude through fitness and nutrition today.
Yeah, precisely. That's it then. As a coach, do you then feel that there's not enough done to help people understand the responsibility they've then got around their clients?
Repeat that question one more time.
Do you feel like there's not enough for coaches around the responsibility that they've got towards their clients?
Oh yeah, because, I think so. I see what you mean. I think so for sure. I think people don't really understand like what a responsibility is when you have someone's nutrition and training and also mental health to an extent. Yes, you're not a therapist, but it all, like you said, plays a role in what you do. What you eat plays a role in how you feel, you know?
Correct.
Your body recovers, what you do, it all works together. So I think some people don't understand the responsibility of that. Maybe they just want an extreme volume of clients, or they just want to see someone look crazy or whatever. They just want to please these people. And you have to be smart enough and knowledgeable enough and just honestly kind and compassionate enough to not take that route. Yeah, I agree.
One of the programs that I've launched, which is being like an affiliated therapist within a coaching platform. So these bodybuilding coaches who are now approaching me saying, Jim, listen, like I've got 30, 40, 50 clients, whatever it might be. And when they start approaching me about their mental health, I don't know what to do. So now I now integrate into their coaching platforms and I help manage clients' mental health. And actually, it's a great idea, right? Because then you're getting access to a therapist within your coaching platform. I present content every other week and I speak to your clients and I'm embedded and I'm in your WhatsApp groups or your school or whatever platform it is you choose to use. I'm engaged with them and I'm posting reading. And if you've got lots of performance clients because you've got lots of bodybuilders, I get into that. Or if you've got lots of lifestyle clients, we then, you know, do about loads around things like everything from self-acceptance and resilience development to like philosophy. You know, I go down the route of philosophy chat with people. People always find philosophy really fascinating. And it's just so interesting because as health and fitness becomes more and more prevalent, like how is this going to grow? Because this is going to grow, right? So I'm making a prediction. This is particularly pertinent in the UK, but in America, it'll become a thing as well. Soon coaching platforms are going to be a coach like yourself programming exercise, you'll have a nutritionist programming food, you'll have a therapist supporting with their mental health, doing running therapy training. I don't think it'll be long before you have a general practitioner of medicine in there as well.
Really?
I think lifestyle medicine, because lifestyle medicine is growing. I don't think it'll be long before you have lifestyle medicine platforms. So if you want an appointment with your doctor, your coach organizes that.
Interesting. But yeah. You're right, because I feel like with health, like it really, it's not just like one thing. Like you said, it all culminates. So yeah, and really, like you said, the mindset is such a missing piece. Like if your mentality is not there, if your mental health is in shambles, like you can't do anything. You can't do anything, you know? So that's so true. That's so true. And
how many coaches have got doctors on their platforms?
Probably.
Make friends with a doctor, find out what it costs them to present something about health, like lifestyle, everything from whatever to whatever, from what alcohol actually does in the body. Like all of a sudden you're introducing a real level of health into your training that people aren't. But that I promise you, I think that's going to, because a lot of these programs that I'm working on in private healthcare in the UK are veering towards that.
No, that's so interesting. And I will say, I feel like, obviously, yeah, you've talked about this for my listeners. James is in the UK, which is awesome. He's meeting with me. But yeah, I feel like that's not as prevalent in the States. I really don't. Like what you're talking about, of course we know this, but I would say it's not as well researched. It's not as well known. People don't talk about it as much. And it sounds like where you're at currently is talking about this more. And it's so important. It's so important.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the lifestyle medicine platform, like people aren't doing that. Like in the UK, but because we've got the NHS here, but what you have to do this is, we've gone off on a business tangent now. And I have some time.
We have to chill. But, I know. We're almost done. We got to wrap this one up. I know.
But yeah, it is that if you can create a demand that only you can supply. So in the UK, the NHS is like really struggling. So we have a national health service. So more and more people are going private, and more of those private doctors are saying, you need to lose weight. You need to just, it's just health behaviors. Like, I can't do anything as a doctor until you've lost 3 stone. So now we're going, well, why don't we just create these platforms whereby there's a doctor, a nutritionist, a PT, and a therapist? Why are we not doing that? It's the future of medicine. I genuinely believe that. I do genuinely believe that.
Yeah, no, I love that. And James, I know we're getting close on time. Typically, my episodes are like 20, 30 minutes. I know we're already close to an hour. So, no, but it's awesome. I hope everyone is kind of enjoying this. I know I am. Like I said, you have just so much to share. I absolutely love it. But I want to try to kind of finish up on just a couple of different notes. One thing I want to, or I guess last question that I want to kind of ask you that I want to end with is, so this is actually a new series on my cool. show. This is the first one. You're the first guest. So thank you again for coming on.
Amazing.
This series
thank you.
Is called, you're welcome. This series is called Find Your Fortitude. So it's really just about, you know, different stories from multiple different people sharing how they've overcome so many challenges in their life through grace and through courage. So I want to ask you specifically, what's been a really defining moment in your life? And maybe you already mentioned this, but I want to bring it back up one more time. If you could put a pinpoint on a defining moment in your life to where you've really leaned on your mental fortitude to overcome that specific trial or tribulation in your life. I know it's a deep question.
When did I most need resilience? I think there was a time in my mid to late 20s where I was really suicidal. I'd lost effectively access to my daughter. I have a lovely relationship, and like I have a great relationship with her mum now, but like my daughter just stays with me like loads. It's beautiful. I see her all the time, but there was a time when I wasn't allowed to see her because my mental health was really bad and lots of other stuff. And I was in a really bad place at work. And I just thought the world is a better place without me. And actually when we kind of look into that, I said before about nothing makes sense until you view it through the lens of evolutionary biology. We're beginning to understand suicidality is actually like a really deeply ingrained human behavior whereby we're trying to remove ourselves from the gene pool because we're worried that the tribe would have weaker babies because of us. So that was an element to it. And so there's just this element of real suicidality. And I just remember thinking, because I got into reading and I read loads of great stories, you know, like Lord of the Rings or whatever. I promise this all links together, Lord of the Rings. And what I realized is that actually no hero is perfect, like just survive the night. And it was just left foot, right foot, your body will follow. Get through the night, then get through the next day, get to work, get dressed, like just make it like to the next meal.
Just having that day by day mentality, like just keep moving like, forward.
It went to meal to meal, like get to breakfast.
Wow.
Get to lunch, like don't hurt yourself between lunch and dinner. It literally got to that point. And actually I realized that no hero is perfect, right? Everybody has these times in their lives whereby they have to, I'm not calling myself a hero, that not at all, sorry, it's a coined phrase, but like that like Tolkien talks about where like Frodo is a deeply flawed hero and Boromir are deeply flawed heroes. Like you can be the good guy, but you can make mistakes, and you can be the good guy and you can have bad days, and you can be the good guy and it can get down to I am dragging myself to the next day. And what you have to do is you have to keep dragging yourself to the next day. And going through the therapy and understanding my mental health and why I was doing what I was doing and why I was who I was and what was going on, like that knowledge really set me free.
I love that. No, yes. What a defining moment. And then also, yeah, what a good piece of advice to kind of end on too. Like just keep moving forward, take it day by day, take it meal by meal if you need to. Yeah. All you can do is really just keep moving forward and have that mentality to build strength. So thank you so much, seriously, for all of your time, all of your knowledge. I hope that the listeners love this. I'm sure that they will. And thank you guys out there for listening to another episode of the Curls and Courage podcast. James, let me ask you too, before we end today's show, is there anything else you want to share with my audience or tell them also what are the best ways that they can reach you if they want online therapy or they want to view your courses or content? Tell us all of that. And then also link it in the show notes below. But give us everything you can.
Yeah. So if you want to find me, I am on Instagram as James Elliott Official. And I'm also on LinkedIn as James Elliott. I can only manage two platforms. I've got Frolicking in the Woods to do. Yeah, I got Eat Berries and Frolic in the Woods. I also wrote a book, James Elliott, Think Yourself Resilient. It's available on Amazon. You can get it in America. It's also available on Audible and as an ebook. So
amazing. Well, thank you so much. Yeah, you guys definitely check him out. Again, his content is so inspiring, so motivating as well. So thank you guys so much for tuning in to this episode. Thank you again one more time, James, for coming on. And as always, I wish you guys blessings and the best mental and physical health possible. They truly work in relationship together. I will talk to you guys next Thursday and hope you have an amazing rest of your day.